This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK. This podcast is sponsored by Wise, the app for doing things in other currencies. If you're sending or spending money abroad, you should use Wise. You'll have up to 40 currencies in the palm of your hand. Wise gives you the real exchange rate, which means you'll spend less on fees and more of your money gets where you need it to be. Download the Wise app today. Or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
I'm Arturo Castro, and I've been lucky enough to do stuff like Broad City, Narcos, Roadhouse, but now I'm coming out with my own podcast. Get ready for Greatest Escapes, a new comedy podcast about the wildest true escape stories in history. Each week, I'll be sitting down with some of the most hilarious actors and writers and comedians, people like Ed Helms, Diane Guerrero, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I love storytelling, and I love you.
Listen to Greatest Escapes on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Greatest Escapes to start listening.
Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 13th of February. I'm Jane Hill. As world leaders and defence officials arrive in Munich, there is much to talk about at the annual security conference there. How does Europe respond to President Trump's overtures to Vladimir Putin? And what does it mean for the future of Ukraine and of NATO? In a tumultuous week for the Gaza ceasefire, we hear from the parents of some of the hostages so far released by Hamas. They tell us how their daughters were treated during 15 months of captivity. And I've been chatting to the 100-year-old woman whose age isn't stopping her from taking part in the pastime she has loved since childhood, horse riding. As heads of state and government and defence and security officials arrive in Munich tonight on the eve of the annual security conference, there is no doubt what's dominating thoughts and conversations. President Trump's overtures to Russia's Vladimir Putin. What does it mean for the war in Ukraine and the future of NATO? Its Secretary General, at a meeting earlier in the day in Brussels, called for Western unity in the face of what's emerged from Washington over the last 48 hours. As we approach the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of its sovereign neighbour, the US president insisted that Kyiv won't be frozen out of discussions about ending the war. But he's doubled down on Ukraine not joining NATO, even saying he understood Russia's argument against it.
I don't see any way that a country in Russia's position could allow them, just in their position, could allow them to join NATO. I don't see that happening. And long before President Putin, Russia was very strong on the fact that I believe that's the reason the war started.
He was also asked whether he trusted Vladimir Putin when he said he wants peace.
Yeah, I do. I believe he wants peace. I believe that President Putin, when I spoke to him yesterday, I mean, I know him very well. Yeah, I think he wants peace. I think he would tell me if he didn't.
Do I think
I'd like to see peace.
Do you trust President Putin?
I believe that he would like to see something happen. I trust him on this subject.
And President Trump added that it was a mistake for Russia to be thrown out of the G7 after Moscow annexed Ukraine's Crimea region back in 2014. He told reporters gathered in the Oval Office that he would love Russia to rejoin the group. Well, Kaya Kallas is the European Union's foreign policy chief, and what she said earlier in Brussels sounded like a strongly worded pushback to any possibility of Washington and Moscow foisting a peace deal on Ukraine or Europe.
It is clear that any deal behind our backs will not work. Any agreement will need also Ukraine and Europe being part of it. And this is clear that appeasement also always fails.
Well, let's talk first tonight to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. He's at that meeting in Munich. Evening to you, Frank. And just in the last hour or so, we've learnt that US and Russian officials will be meeting where you are tomorrow. President Trump said, Ukraine is also invited, by the way. That's a quote. Do you think Ukraine is cornered here, finding itself at these talks?
It's in a very tough position. I mean, I was here last year, Jane, and President Zelensky strode right past me, very purposeful. He was having a lot of meetings with people, but there were no Russians that I was aware of at this conference last year. For President Trump to say that there are going to be high-level Russians attending this. This is news to most people here. You know, the Russians are not generally considered to be welcome since at this event, since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 22. So it's quite dizzying the pace at which things are changing. The whole paradigm is shifting right underneath people's feet. I mean, a week ago, it was still very much the NATO mantra that Ukraine would be supported, it would take whatever it took. And there are still people still clinging to that. But the fact is that Ukraine is not in the driving seat, NATO isn't in the driving seat, Europe is not in the driving seat. It's Donald Trump, President Trump. And he is moving things very quickly. He has decided to bring President Putin in from the cold, ending the three-year pariah status. I mean, yes, okay, there's still huge economic sanctions on Russia, but the fact that they're talking about sitting down together in Saudi Arabia, visiting each other's capitals, pushing a deal. When Donald Trump says he wants peace and that he believes Vladimir Putin wants peace, yeah, sure, Putin wants peace, but on his terms. And the whole idea of NATO's, for the last 3 years, of everything NATO has been doing to support Ukraine was to try to put it in a strong position for when it came to peace talks, that it would be able to negotiate from a position of strength. That is not the case. It is now in a position of weakness, and Donald Trump has signaled, you know what, time's up. You know, we're going to have a deal, whether you like it or not.
Yes, and we've heard, haven't we, all day European leaders trying to react to those comments coming out of the Trump administration. I mean, those strong words from the EU's foreign policy chief using the word appeasement. I mean, are you picking up on a sense there, Frank, that European leaders are actually going to start really talking now about the need to boost their own military capabilities?
Well, the conference hasn't officially begun yet. That's going to kick off in a few hours' time, but definitely. I think that there is, I mean, quite a lot of people have been saying for some time, experienced military and defense people have been saying, not the politicians, but defense people have been saying, we are desperately underfunded. The peace dividend has run its course years ago. And, you know, now is the time to try and boost Europe's industrial defense capability, because that is what is helping Russia to win the war in Ukraine. You know, leaving aside President Trump's views, the fact is that Russia has put its entire economy onto a war footing. It allocates nearly 40% of the state budget to defense. President Putin has appointed an economist as his defense minister. All of that means that Russian factories are churning out equipment because they're losing it at an astronomical rate on the battlefield, but they're replenishing it. And it's the same when it comes to human beings. They're losing around 1,000 casualties a day. Ukraine's losing a lot of men too, not as many, but they can't afford to lose them. But Russia is able to replenish them. It's got vast reserves, both in men and material. So if the Russians are going to be here in the next few hours at this conference, they are going to be walking proud and tall because they've got the leader of the free world saying, it's time to talk to them and let's do a deal. And it's the fear here in Europe is that this is going to be a deal on Russia's terms. In other words, Ukraine has got to give up all the territory Russia's already seized, give up any hope of joining NATO, probably give up a hope of joining the EU, no hope of getting US troops as a guarantor to prevent a future invasion. And the fear is that Russia will use this ceasefire that's coming to rearm, restock, rebuild, and then in a few years' time, possibly after Donald Trump has left office, come back and take the rest of Ukraine.
Frank, thanks so much. Frank Gardner there tonight in Munich. Let's stay with those thoughts of European countries boosting their military, how they respond to everything that's coming out of the Trump administration. Let's discuss all of that with Peter Bator, who's a former Slovak ambassador to NATO. A very good evening to you. I hope you were able to hear that there from Munich, but I'm really interested in your thoughts, first of all, on what now for European countries? What do they have to do now?
Yeah, I think they should first show unity. You know, we've been discussing all the scenarios, how the U.S. elections may end up. And I think there was so much wishful thinking that, you know, that the result would be different. But instead of that, we should have been just preparing for this scenario, just to stand equally strong and to show President Trump that there is a strong Europe that can take care of at least part of its own security, and not only resource-wise, but also political-wise. So to be ready to take important decisions that would lead to stronger Europe. But unfortunately, I haven't seen this happening.
You haven't. I mean, we heard what Pete Hegseth said, Defense Secretary, U.S. Defense Secretary. Europe needs to take responsibility for its own security, spend more on defense. Is there the political will for that, do you think?
I don't. Yeah. I mean, if we talk about 2% of GDP for defense, then there is a lot of political will. But is it enough? It's definitely not. Is the 3% enough? I have my doubts. That would be really the bare minimum, and it would not cover everything that we need, you know, for the new capabilities to be developed and also to be able to help Ukraine further. But I would maybe I would be more provocative, and I would say that, you know, this money thing is the easier part of it. Because, you know, if we wanted, of course, we could invest more. But there's also this political will to do more, not just to invest into our defense. But just imagine there would be a request on Europe, just, I don't know, to generate a force of 30, 40, 50,000 men strong and to be sent to Ukraine as sort of peacekeeping force. Would this be... would this be possible on the European continent? I can imagine the debates, and I can imagine also the political comfort of many European leaders just having a serious impact on saying, you know, this is impossible. So I would say the money is not the biggest problem that we have in Europe.
Well, along with money, there's the call for unity. I mean, we've heard it from the head of NATO and others. How concerned are you that can be done in the sense that there are some European countries, your own potentially, who have some sympathies for Russia, for Vladimir Putin?
Yeah. Yes. Indeed. That's Slovakia. That's definitely Hungary. Let's wait for the elections in the Czech Republic. But also, let's look at Bulgaria and Romania. Maybe, you know, the situation is also quite fluid there. So yes, there is a risk that there would not be enough unity. And, you know, if we have to discuss the, I would say, more controversial things, then it doesn't come only to the Central European or Eastern European region, but also it's the other EU and NATO members that would simply say, you know, this cannot be on the table. So, because Peter, some decisions would really require a lot of political will and courage.
Peter Battle, very many thank you. Very many thanks, former Slovak ambassador to NATO. Coming up here a little later.
So I've worked at the Bank of England for the best part of a decade.
I spent the best part of a decade as an economist at the Bank of England.
Well, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is under fire for that claim amid accusations that she has embellished her CV. The Prime Minister has backed her. How seriously should we take it all? That's coming up in a while. But before that, after a tumultuous week in the Middle East, in which it looked like a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas had fallen apart, Hamas has now said it will continue to release Israeli hostages as scheduled. There's been no comment from Israel, with the government earlier saying the ceasefire would end unless the hostages were freed. Meanwhile, the families of some of those released so far have been speaking to the BBC about their treatment during 15 months in captivity. The parents of four female hostages say they were given little food, witnessed another hostage being beaten, and were threatened by armed men as they were held both in tunnels and in buildings above ground. Alice Cuddy sent this report from Jerusalem.
It was a nightmare, they warned of, but no one seemed to have listened. In a video filmed by Hamas and later released by the hostage families, you can hear the woman pleading in English.
Someone speak English.
The last remaining female observers, the soldiers who watched Gaza's border, were released in the first weeks of the ceasefire after more than 15 months in captivity. Now home with their families.
And the feeling was that I will take care of you now. I will take care of you now and everything will be okay. Now daddy's here and that's all. Everything was quiet.
Yoni Levy's 20-year-old daughter Nama started at the Nahal Oz military base just the day before October 7th. In captivity, held for long periods without sunlight, he says she heard him calling for her release.
She heard me talking on the TV. She saw her pictures, and it gave her a lot of hope. Everybody's fighting for her, for her release. Nobody forgot her, and we'll do whatever we need to take her out of this hell.
For more than a year, the families have prayed for the return of their loved ones. The childhood sweetheart of one of the observers, Daniela Gilboa, even shouted a marriage proposal towards Gaza in the hope that she might somehow hear.
Daniela Tinasini!
Her mother, Oli Gilboa, says Daniela was moved frequently from underground tunnels to homes hidden from view. They watched a release of the latest three male hostages at the weekend and cried together. Ellie Sharabi, one of those who appeared emaciated, is their cousin.
She told me, Mommy, if I were released 2 months ago, I probably looked like them. She lost a lot of her weight through the captivity. In the last 2 months, they got a lot of food so they can gain weight.
During her captivity, Hamas had released a propaganda video that suggested Daniela had been killed, a video that we now know Daniela was forced to stage.
It was really the hardest moment of my life because in the first moments, I think everyone that saw it, we believe it. But I just kept telling myself that it can't be. You must believe that she come back home alive.
These are among the first interviews with close family members since the hostages have been released, and their parents say full details of what happened to them are still emerging. There are things they can't say, fearful that it may put the 76 hostages still held in Gaza at risk.
She's saying that they are playing all the times with her gun and with her hand grenades. It's fighting.
Shlomi Berger's daughter, Agam, is a 19-year-old violinist, among the women who had just started at the base. Her father says she knows her own mind and was shocked by the way women were treated.
There was times that she was threatened, and sometimes they torture other hostages, female hostages, in front of her eyes. It happened in the same room.
Now, finally home, all the families are calling for the remaining hostages to be urgently released and for answers about why their warnings were missed. They say they will join calls for a national inquiry, one they believe is long overdue. On her return home, Daniela reminded her mum of a stark warning she made just before October 7th.
She told me, Mommy, when I'm going back to the army, there's going to be war. In my worst nightmares, I didn't think it's going to be such a war. And of course, that my daughter will take an hostage.
And that report from Jerusalem was by Alice Cuddy. Well, all this week, we're taking time on the programme to hear how Palestinians see their future, from questions of how they rebuild their lives and preserve their culture and identity to the complex issues of who should lead them and what their relationship should be with Israel and other neighbouring countries. Tonight, we hear from the son of a man who's long been tipped as a future Palestinian leader, Marwan Barghouti. He's been behind bars in an Israeli prison for more than 2 decades for murders committed during the Second Intifada, or uprising, during which he emerged as a leader with broad support. Arab Barghouti is his son and an activist in Ramallah in the West Bank. My colleague James Kumarasamy has been speaking to him.
We need to give the Palestinian people, and no other than the Palestinian people, the choice to choose our leadership. It's been almost 2 decades since we had our last elections. If you're a Palestinian and you're 35 years old or under, which is 70% of the Palestinian people, you have never voted before, let alone getting elected or getting into the parliament or something like that.
Is there a hunger for elections?
There is a hunger, a big hunger for elections and for unity. I think a unified Palestinian people contributes greatly into the future of peace. We do need one umbrella that holds all Palestinian factions under it, that represents the whole of the Palestinian people as well. And we have young people who are very qualified to be in the political scene, that we have never been able to get our voices heard.
Where does Hamas fit in?
I think that Hamas is a political party like any other party. I hope to see a unified Palestinian people, which includes all Palestinian factions with no exceptions.
So Hamas could be part of the group of parties who rule the Gaza Strip still?
I think it's only the right of the Palestinian people to choose our leadership. Enough with Western governments to come and tell us who we can vote for and who we can't vote for, who we can label a terrorist and who we can label a good guy. They're not qualified to do that.
So your father himself, he's still in prison. You don't know whether he's likely to be released under this ceasefire deal. Is that correct?
We're not sure and we're not certain, but we're very positive and optimistic that he will be part of any future deal, along with all Palestinian political prisoners.
Your father has long been spoken about as a potential leader of the Palestinians. Is that still how you see it? Is it how he sees it?
It's not how I see it or even he sees it. I think it has to do with what the Palestinian people want. And I think that it's not a coincidence that he was leading the polls for more than 20 years. The most important question now is, why is he still the most popular leader in Palestine? He's someone who is a unifying figure. His political vision aligns perfectly with the international community, which is the vision that says that he supports the two-state solution, supports any political solution that contributes into the Palestinian freedom. He's a leader who's known for his anti-corruption policies. He's someone who's willing to sacrifice personally for the cause. And that's the type of leader that the Palestinian people look for.
Is he a leader, though, that the Israelis could work with? He has been in prison. He was found guilty of leading the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a military group. He's always denied that in attacks that killed 5 people. But given that history, do you think that the Israelis would work with him?
It depends on what the Israelis want. If the Israelis want a long-term peace and coexistence with the Palestinian people, I think that they have a perfect partner for peace. Because you need to remember that my father is someone who has a long experience in negotiating with the Israelis to sustain the peace process back in the 90s. It was only because the Israelis violated the Oslo Accords that he supported the Second Intifada. And he's someone who supports the Palestinian struggle. And not only him, even the international law says clearly that any occupied people have the right to resist their occupier.
Arab Barghouti there, and we will hear more perspectives on what the future holds for Palestinians in the coming.
This podcast is sponsored by Wise, the app for doing things in other currencies. If you're sending or spending money abroad, you should use Wise. You'll have up to 40 currencies in the palm of your hand. Wise gives you the real exchange rate, which means you'll spend less on fees and more of your money gets where you need it to be. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Hey, Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business Small Business Success Stories, produced by Ruby Studio and Intuit QuickBooks. Catch up on seasons 1 and 2 and join us for a brand new season of the podcast as we talk to small business owners about how they manage and grow their businesses with the help of platforms like Intuit QuickBooks.
Listen to Mind the Business Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Days. Back to tonight, though, because President Trump isn't just focusing on Russia and Ukraine. He has also announced a new policy to impose reciprocal tariffs, declaring that America's allies are worse than our enemies when it comes to import taxes. It's not yet clear what impact that could have here. The president says he will be addressing each country one by one. Well, meanwhile, his government continues to take shape. His controversial nominee for Health Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has narrowly secured approval by the US Senate. And the Senate Judiciary Committee has advanced the president's pick as FBI Director, Kash Patel, to a final vote before the full chamber. But a senior Democrat has demanded an investigation, suggesting that Mr. Patel might have misled the committee. Senator Richard J. Durbin of Illinois has written to the US Justice Department, citing what he says is highly credible information from multiple sources that Kash Patel was personally involved in covertly orchestrating a purge of career officials at the FBI. So who is Kash Patel, and why does Donald Trump want him to run the FBI? I asked Emily Jasinski, the Washington correspondent for website unheard.com, who used to write for the influential conservative news site The Federalist.
Kash Patel is one of the most interesting figures in Donald Trump's orbit because he actually came to be well-known in MAGA circles and actually really more broadly in American politics when he was a staffer on Capitol Hill during the investigation of allegations that Donald Trump had colluded during his 2016 presidential campaign with Russia. Kash Patel, people on the right see him as being instrumental in pushing back on those allegations, from their perspective, disproving those allegations. That's how he rose to prominence, was actually pushing back on the FBI itself. And that's why his nomination to lead the FBI. He comes from a background of being a public defender, working inside the Justice Department, then working on Capitol Hill, becoming something of a podcaster after he worked on Capitol Hill between Donald Trump's two administrations, and now potentially leading the FBI. He's actually one of the agency's sharpest critics and has said very extreme things about what should happen to the FBI. So that's where he's become a lightning rod for both the left and the right on this nomination.
Right. So assuming he goes through, what are his plans for the FBI, do we think?
Well, he said things like he would on day one turn the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover headquarters in downtown Washington into a, quote, museum of the deep state because he wants to send people out into different parts of the country to, as he puts it, actually police crime, actually solve crimes. And so I think one thing we will see is a refocusing of resources from D.C. to other parts of the country. That's a sort of charitable expectation. From the perspective of whether he'll kind of burn it all down. He's talked about wanting to burn it all down, but during his confirmation hearings was, you know, much more, I would say, serious and substantive about, you know, saying he wants people to just be able to do their jobs without politicization.
I mean, we've seen, for example, at the Justice Department, we've seen officials being removed or reassigned, particularly those who had previously investigated Donald Trump. So the critics will say these government departments are being used for the Trump administration's own ends.
This is what worries me. There's probably truth to the fact that, you know, somebody like Kash Patel will be very tempted to go after political enemies, and it could happen. Part of the problem is that some of those political enemies themselves acted improperly. And so part of it is like, yes, there is going to be, there likely will be political attacks. Some of the people, not all of them, may not have a lot of credibility because they were involved in some politicization at the Bureau too.
But removing people from their jobs precisely because they had, and purely because they had been involved in an investigation involving Donald Trump, that is politicization, surely.
They would argue that it's politicization in an effort to depoliticize, which is a crazy argument, and you start going down a kind of rabbit hole.
Are there actually some Republicans who would have concerns about what might happen to the FBI under Kash Patel? Some who would think privately, maybe not saying it publicly, but they think actually the FBI plays a role. It's a vital role. Security is important. You know, you mess with the FBI at your peril. Are there those whispers on Capitol Hill?
Hugely. That is absolutely true. I actually talked to a source yesterday who's been involved in the confirmation process for Tulsi Gabbard, who was explaining that a lot of these Republican senators had to be cajoled and coerced, essentially, into voting for some of the more unorthodox nominees. They're perfectly orthodox from the perspective of Trumpism, which is very different than traditional Republicanism. But a lot of Republican senators, in particular, are uncomfortable with how intensely many of these nominees talk about reforming the agencies or departments that they have now been confirmed to lead. So there's definitely a level of discomfort with people like Kash Patel. They do have to be convinced. You know, there have to be, MAGA World had to threaten some people with primaries. This happened with Senator Joni Ernst and Pete Hegseth. She kind of wavered on his nomination and was very quickly brought back into line because of threats like that. So yes, and I think what we will see is pretty stiff oversight from some Republican senators. Bill Cassidy did not want to vote for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but got Bobby Kennedy Jr. to agree to meet with him monthly and to, you know, sort of do check-ins with him, almost like a toddler, according to Bill Cassidy. So there is serious concern. And it was really only the threat of primaries and falling out of sort of alliance with or alignment with Donald Trump that put people in line.
Emily Jasinski there from Unheard. Now, let's return to the UK. And if I'm lucky enough to make it to 100, I hope I'm going to be as active as someone I spoke to a little earlier this evening. Elizabeth Breton has reached that milestone and goes out twice a week to enjoy something she has loved since childhood, horse riding. She actually gave up the pastime in her 40s, but went back to it 30 years later at a time when most of us are relaxing in retirement. Elizabeth told me about her earliest memories of getting into the saddle.
My home was a farm in Lincolnshire, and at the turn of the century, if you didn't go hunting, you had very little social life. If you wanted to go out in the evening, you had to order a carriage and horses and goodness knows what. So the hunting field was a splendid place to socialise. I was given a little grey pony, a very pretty little pony, when I was 6, I think. But by that time I could ride. I mean, I do not remember ever learning to rise to the trot or anything else. I just rode.
I'm assuming that means then that you never had any fear. It sounds to me as if it was all second nature to you.
You could say that, yes. You know, if you were on a horse and you met a steamroller or something, well, we're certainly scared, but there's something in me that rises to the challenge when the actual scare happens, and I make the horse do what I want it to do.
But why did you give up?
We had the war, and I joined up. I was part of the Fannies, First Aid Nursing Yeomanry, who were reconstituted to codes, send messages to the Free French, and it was scary because if the Germans captured one, they were pretty horrid. And I was not a wireless operator, which I think I would have found very stressful, because if you asked an agent to repeat a message, you knew that they were in danger of being found by the Germans who had this special search equipment.
So that was some remarkable work you did in that period. What then brought you back to horses and your love of that world?
Horses had a huge attraction for me. I love horses, any horse. But I hear a horse clip-clopping anywhere, I'm immediately interested. So it really is part of my DNA to like horses.
Can you remember what it was like the first time you got back into the saddle in, I think, in your 70s?
I didn't feel very safe for 2 or 3 months, I don't think. And then I really felt right back into it and went out hunting, and I was completely back as I used to be.
And you were competing?
That's probably what I was best at, was race riding, but you know, women couldn't race except in the ladies' races, which was an absolute pain in the neck. I wanted to do the eventing, and jumping was very important to me. I didn't feel I'd really done anything unless I'd done some jumps.
Do you feel as comfortable in the saddle today, at the remarkable age you now are, if you don't mind me saying, as you were when you first got back onto a horse in your 70s?
Well, no, I don't.
But you still go out?
Because I know that that's what does me so much good. I don't know when I started this aim, but my aim was to ride when I was 100. And when I achieved that, I felt a bit rudderless. So now I've set myself a new target, and that's my grandson's wedding on August the 9th. But I shan't mind if I don't make it. I hope he won't mind either.
The indomitable Elizabeth Breton. What a pleasure to talk to her. Now, the Prime Minister has given his backing to the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, after questions were raised about inaccuracies in her CV and her use of expenses in a previous job. A BBC investigation found that the Chancellor's profile on the professional networking site LinkedIn had exaggerated the length of time she worked at the Bank of England before she was an MP. She spent 5.5 years there, but she's said publicly that she spent the best part of a decade at the bank. And it's also emerged that she and two colleagues were the subject of an expenses probe while working at HBOS, Halifax Bank of Scotland. So how serious is all of this? Let's ask two people very much plugged into the Westminster world, Lucy Fisher from the Financial Times and James Kirkup, columnist for The Spectator and The Times, who's also with the communications consultancy Appella Advisors. Very good evening to both of you. James Kirkup, what are we to make of all of this?
Not very much. I'm afraid this is a fairly, it's a fairly trivial story all around. I was quite surprised this morning when, along with about 14 million people who use the BBC News app, I got a breaking news alert on my phone telling me that Rachel Reeves' LinkedIn page was 6 months off in one of her career entries from 20 years ago. I don't know why we're making such a big fuss about this.
The bit about expenses, though, from someone who is the Chancellor?
Well, can I read to you from the BBC online story about the expenses? There is no evidence of which we're aware that the bank's internal investigation was completed or that there was ever a concluding finding of any wrongdoing.
Lucy, trivial. That's what James says. What do you think?
Well, I think the story about the expenses, I agree with James in that it's just not nailed on. You know, the claim is that she was investigated. Her allies say she was not aware of any investigation. She was not interviewed as part of any investigation. And there's no suggestion by the BBC that this sort of concluded in any disciplinary action. So I'm just not sure what the sort of, you know, bones of that story really amount to. I think with the question marks over her CV, there is a bit more of a pattern of perhaps slight exaggeration that might at best be put down to a looseness around details. Of course, it's emerged previously that she described having worked for the Bank of England for the best part of a decade. You know, it was just under 6 years, which you know, clearly isn't a decade. But again, allies say, look, it's a turn of phrase and a slight sort of misspeaking. For me, the biggest question mark that has been sort of raised about her integrity, which is what I think critics who are leaping on these very minor details are trying to sort of whip up, it really comes back to allegations of plagiarism in the book she wrote about female economists. You know, there were whole passages found to have been kind of ripped from the internet. And I think that is a little bit more concerning. But overall, I'd agree with James, the revelations today don't necessarily amount to much. And I think her political woes about, you know, weak economic growth and higher than expected debt interest payments will be giving her many more sleepless nights than this.
So, James, the fact that this is creating considerable ripples in Westminster, what's going on there then? What's that about?
It's not really creating ripples. The BBC is right. We're reasonably promoting its own story. And to be fair, it is a legitimate story. It's absolutely fair for journalists to ask.
Well, and the Prime Minister did feel the need to give his backing.
Well, because he was asked the question. It's absolutely fair to ask questions of whether politicians are telling the truth. It's necessary to have a certain sense of proportion. As Lucy said, there are vastly more important things on Rachel Reeves' in tray. You know, there are many, many more important things we should talk about in terms of her performance as Chancellor. We could talk about debt interest. We could talk about public spending. We could talk about pension reform, defence spending, lots of things like that. I have to admit, I've been knocking at Westminster for 25 plus years. I've seen lots of allegations thrown at lots of politicians. I sadly conclude that there are people in politics and journalism, certainly on social media, who do not like the fact that we have a woman as Chancellor, and therefore Rachel Reeves being subject to a higher degree of scrutiny and criticism over ephemera, personal ephemera, than other people who have done that job are facing.
I think that's really interesting.
That's a fact. I don't include the BBC journalists doing today's story in that at all. I think this is more about what we sometimes call political discourse around Rachel Reeves.
Very interesting. Very quickly, Lucy, is gender a factor here?
I'm not as convinced it is. I think more it's a Labour issue. A typical attack against Labour's credibility in handling the economy means that whoever is a Labour chancellor in charge of the public purse strings is going to face a lot more focused scrutiny. And I think that's why perhaps we've seen more investigation of her CV and credentials.
Very good to talk to both of you. Thanks very much for your time tonight. Thank you. Lucy Fisher from the Financial Times and James Kirkup from The Spectator and The Times. And that is The World Tonight from the whole team here and me, Jane Hill. We all wish you a very good night.
This podcast is sponsored by Wise, the app for doing things in other currencies. If you're sending or spending money abroad, you should use Wise. You'll have up to 40 currencies in the palm of your hand. Wise gives you the real exchange rate, which means you'll spend less on fees and more of your money gets where you need it to be. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Hey, Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business Small Business Success Stories, produced by Ruby Studio and Intuit QuickBooks. Catch up on seasons 1 and 2 and join us for a brand new season of the podcast as we talk to small business owners about how they manage and grow their businesses with the help of platforms like Intuit QuickBooks.
Listen to Mind the Business Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.